Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the TakeCast. I'm Davis Matic. You can find me on Twitter at Davis Matic. In this episode of the show, I'm joined by my buddy Peter Overzet to recap the final episodes 9 and 10 of ESPN's The Last Dance, the Michael Jordan documentary. Also, just sort of wrapping up the entire show as a whole, you know, our thoughts on Michael Jordan. Thoughts on, you know, his legacy, how as younger guys who were not there for all of Michael Jordan's dominance, you know, how the documentary impacted our opinion of him and basketball today. I think this will be interesting for a lot of you. You know, I think a lot of us enjoyed the documentary. I think a lot of us thought it was great. So this is the final episode that we will do on ESPN's The Last Dance. If you want to support the show, leaving some rating and review on iTunes would be great. That would be helpful. If you want bonus episodes of the show, you can get them on patreon.com/takecast. Everyone, thank you very much for listening. And now let's go ahead and get into the episode. All right, everyone, bringing in Peter Overzet to the show. Final episodes of The Last Dance, episodes 9 and 10. You know, we're here, a quiet, reflective morning as The Last Dance has ended, basking in the afterglow of German soccer and The Last Dance. How did you enjoy episodes 9 and 10, Pete?
I enjoyed it. It's like one of those things where the storytelling that they did in that was very effective. And you even see tweets this morning about, like, I have completely, you know, changed my opinion on who's the greatest of all time after the documentary. And that director has to be sitting somewhere going, I did my job correctly, because it had an emotional pull on people, and it was just really well made. And now I'm kind of at the point where I'm pulling back a little bit and being like, okay, how much of this is recency bias, really good storytelling, and where's actually the truth in this story? Because I think we can both agree there's been some liberties taken by Jordan and the directors to shade Michael in a much more positive light.
Yeah, so, I mean, clearly this was done with Michael Jordan's guiding hand, right? Like, we're getting Michael's side of the story, and we're skipping on... I mean, probably the most amazing thing is Michael's kids don't show up until episode 10 at the beginning, that Jazz series. I mean, it was quite a Michael Jordan thing to have his kids just not be a part of this at all, basically.
Yeah, what's the one quote from the kids that get in there? Like, yeah, man, the stadium in Utah, it was pretty crazy.
It's like, yeah, it was wild. Yeah, like I'm not wavering on my position that LeBron is a better player, because like I think that should be obvious. But I certainly am in the camp that Michael Jordan had the more impactful, meaningful, great career, basically.
Yeah, and the thing is, I forget, I think it was someone at The Ringer made this analogy. It, like, Jordan is the greatest story ever. Like, everything from his upbringing to not making the high school team, like the arc of winning, retiring, coming back for the second act. They were comparing it to, like, Joseph Campbell's The Hero's Journey. It was
right.
Like, Jordan is the best story, and people get upset at LeBron because LeBron doesn't have this clean story in the way that Jordan does. And that doesn't take away from either of them, but let's just call a spade. Like, the Jordan story is incredible. You can't beat that.
Yeah, LeBron chose to go about things in, like, he made some missteps, right? Like, well, I guess first of all, those Cavaliers teams were, I mean, just obviously way worse than these, even the early Bulls teams were better than those early Cavs teams. And then Instead of retiring, LeBron has the decision, which is, like, you know, one of the most misguided. I mean, he should have hired you as his you know, his publicist or whatever. You would have been able to tell him that was a bad idea.
I think everybody would have. But that is kind of the funny thing, that, you know, both of the way Jordan's first three titles when he went into retirement, you know, everyone, it was so weird that people had all these theories about, obviously, is it a gambling suspension? And then when he ended here, like, both of them didn't make sense, because we see players these days, how competitive they are, how they want to keep playing. Like, this is all they know. That Jordan could just walk away, it again plays into the mythos of he was just wired different than these guys. LeBron couldn't have imagined taking 2 years off until he got the setup that he wanted, right? Like, there's no way in hell.
Yeah, no, there is no way. So I guess getting into some very specific things from the documentary, Rick Smits just looks like a thumb. Like imagine your dynasty, like imagine losing in a playoff series to a team prominently featuring Rick Smits. Like some of these dudes that LeBron dunked on, or that Michael dunked on, like really don't even look like NBA players. Like it, like the whole, you know, MJ played against plumbers thing is, it's a little overblown. But I mean, like, Greg Ostertag was playing 30 minutes a night against him, against the Jazz. Like, he was playing against some really unathletic players.
I remember when I was watching this series as a kid, because I always, I even turned to Lauren when we were watching last night. I was like, did you know Rick Smits was 7'4"? Like, as a kid, that little nugget always stood him. I was like, that is just ridiculously tall. But yes, to your point, Rick Smits, Ostertag, the guy that drives that point home for me the most and actually didn't get any FaceTime in the documentary was Jeff Hornacek. Because there's, yeah, there's Steve Kerr and there's, you know, Stockton. But Hornacek is on another level of, like, this dude just balls out at the rec center. How is he playing in an NBA Finals game right now?
I thought the, you know, about the maybe the 15 minutes they gave Kerr was other than like the last half hour of the whole thing, I thought the Kerr moments were the best that the documentary got. I thought that was like the most human, the most telling, because Kerr is like a really honest guy and Kerr is going to tell you what it was like in those moments. And like, you know, even as MJ is being as forthcoming as we've ever seen him, you never felt like, oh yeah, this is just 100% the story.
Totally. And one other thing that speaks to that, like, Jordan's story speaks for itself, the footage and the storytelling. So Jordan, as an interviewee in the documentary, didn't have to do much heavy lifting. It was like, just react to this, shrug your shoulders, laugh, say this guy was a liar, whatever. But, you know, guys like Reggie and Steve Kerr in that documentary, both incredibly articulate, both really self-aware about what was going on in the situation. And I thought both those interviews, the Reggie and the Steve Kerr, were just fantastic because they are legitimately great interviewees.
Yeah, I mean, Reggie is good on TV. Reggie knows how to, like, speak eloquently about the experiences, right? Like, he knows how to, like, paraphrase, like, what he went through in a way that that makes sense. And, I mean, maybe there's a lot of stuff from other guys that was honest, but it's just not interesting. You know, they probably interviewed Barkley and Ewing or whatever, but those guys probably just weren't as interesting.
Yeah, it would be fascinating to see if it's like Jason made this documentary and then had to run it past MJ for final editorial control. You know, they say there's like a director's cut. It'd be fascinating to see the non-MJ director's cut of this.
I mean, I'm sure there are going to be stories. Like, a lot of this, there's stuff out there that does not make Michael look so cool, right? Like, this whole documentary is, it's not like, this is not an analytical documentary about the character of MJ. Like, this is a glorification of a great basketball player. Like, you know, I guess one of the things is I don't feel like I learned that much. You know what I mean? Like, I don't feel like I have a new appreciation for MJ's career, but I don't feel like I learned that much about him.
Yeah. For me, like, one of the fun things, like you said, it wasn't learning something new, although there was a few things, but it was like watching those highlights and whether it maybe I had seen them live or maybe just from seeing the highlights of them over and over. And I think we talked about this last time, the sheer number of iconic moments. Like, even I think you mentioned Ostertag, the one in that game where Jordan goes underneath and he gets like fouled by Ostertag and kisses it so high off the glass. Like, I've seen that highlight 100 times. Right. I still blows my mind the number of iconic shots in moments Jordan has. It's like they keep showing them, like, I remember this. Like, there's no other athlete in the world who has that many moments.
Yeah, like, I think, I mean, you know, part of that is just how much shit happens. Like, I'm just trying to think of, like, iconic sports moments that I can think of. So I can think of Kyrie's shot. I think of the 3rd-and-15 pass from Mahomes to Tyreek in the Super Bowl. I think of that Lamar Jackson spinning run against the Bengals, right? Like that was huge. Like, that was one of the most gif-able things that we saw on the internet. I think of the Ray Allen corner shot for the Miami Heat against the Spurs. And, you know, like, but like, I can't think of like that many. The LeBron buzzer beater against the Pistons back when he was with the Cavs. Like he hit like a half court one. But I can't think of that many like super iconic moments right now.
Yeah, like I feel, even though it's more recent, I feel like if I saw a documentary about, say, the Warriors or about LeBron, even though I probably lived through them, I feel like way fewer of the moments would have been recognizable. Like, oh, I remember where I was when I saw that. When I'm watching these Jordan ones, I'm like, I remember that.
Yeah, I mean, so I remember when the Cavs won, but it felt like the Warriors wins were so foregone conclusions that it hardly even mattered, right? Like the Warriors were so much better than their opposition. And that, you know what? I think that's actually a big difference. Why these last three championships for the Bulls felt so special is it wasn't like people were not viewing them like they were a foregone conclusion. Like when the season started when the Warriors went 72-9, people actually were not watching the NBA that much that season. Like ratings were down across the board because everyone was just like, oh, you know, the Warriors are just going to win. Like it's two very different things.
Yeah.
John Stockton just straight up looks like an accountant. Like and he talks like one too. He's like the way he was talking about playing against the Bulls was, he was like, you know, they were a good team, and we respected them, and we thought they were great. But you know, we didn't think they were unbeatable. Like he just, like John Stockton just looks like a dad.
Oh, 100%. Yeah, I mean, both him and Steve Kerr, they just don't. And yet, like Stockton was one of the greatest point guards of his generation. I'm glad they did. They specifically called out that pass that he made to Karl Malone, the one-handed cross court one. That was pretty sweet. But yeah, it is still. I have a hard time, the people that really want to compare eras, just looking at some of those guys in imagination.
I mean, John Stockton would be like a 15th man in the G League today, and I don't care if that is triggering to some of you out there. I don't care. It really is the way that it is. So Pippen misses the free throw against the Pacers in that game. This is another example of Pippen getting very lucky that he did not play in the era of social media, because stuff like that, I mean, missing free throws in game sevens, like that's the sort of thing that like guys literally get trashed for the rest of their entire careers. And Pippen just, again, escapes.
Yeah, I think Pippen takes a beating throughout this documentary too, because it's like this catch 22 for him of that, you know, Jordan needed him to accomplish all of this, but you also see the kind of beta-ness in his character throughout all of this as well. Even down to where, how deferential he is and how he's not even that great of an interview in the thing. He just kind of is like very bland, just kind of matter of fact.
He's got that great voice though.
Yeah, I would say in the earlier episodes, he came across as, you know, he got his own episode about how he was underpaid and they pumped him up there. But it was like, that was the only episode where Scotty really came across looking good. Otherwise, it felt like he was the true second fiddle.
I kind of view him as the protagonist of this, because he is like, to me, Pippen is the one who was like the unsung hero at the time, right? Like he's having to put up with Michael Jordan is a megalomaniac. Like he is completely obsessed with himself and his own goals. And Michael should really, I think, and I'm sure he does not consider himself, well, maybe he does a little bit, you know, consider himself lucky to have known Pippen the way that he knew him. But to find someone as good at basketball as Pippen, who had the personality and was as willing to just be like, you know what, I'm totally cool playing second fiddle forever. Like, I mean, he played second fiddle for a decade to Michael, right? You know, yeah. Like you're not, I can't think of a player in Scottie's league who would have ever had that personality in basketball history.
Yeah. I guess I couldn't go as far as saying he's the protagonist, just because like the entire essence of the documentary and Jordan's story is like everyone was just a pawn to him. And yeah. Sure, Scottie was the queen. He was a way more valuable piece to Jordan than other guys, but everyone were pawns and rooks. And if you want to do the grad school film guy, it's like New York City was actually one of the characters in the movie. Like, I feel like the audience and us who grew up with Jordan are that like protagonist. And Jordan is this kind of anti-hero that was using everyone in his universe to tell this story. For us,
right.
If we want to get really literary about it. But yeah, I just, maybe just the way these last few episodes ended, but like Scotty just, it didn't land for me as much.
Well, they're not covering the games where Michael Jordan shot 3 for 20 or got hurt or whatever, but every time yeah. Scotty's back seized up or every time Scotty had a migraine, like we're not talking about the times when MJ rolled his ankle, but every time Scotty gets hurt or comes up short in a big moment, like we're just zoning in on it, right? And I'm sure Michael has no problem with that.
Also, speaking of things, tell me if you think I'm wrong, but would someone in Pippen State with his back in that game coming in and out, you know, playing as a decoy, would that ever happen in today's NBA? Wouldn't you be
the trainers? It wouldn't even if the player wanted to come in, the trainers and the coach would not let it happen today. They'd be like, dude, your back's hurt. Like, we're playing Scotty Burrell 30 minutes tonight.
Yeah. Also, some of those, they showed him scoring 2 buckets, like even with his back, and they were like turnarounds on Hornacek and Stockton. I'm like, how did they allow this mismatch to happen? Like, why are they letting the guy who can't move get 4-foot jumpers over these short guys?
Well, I mean, Jerry Sloan, another guy who comes off looking very shitty in this documentary is Jerry Sloan, who says, I didn't even know Michael was sick during the flu game. Says, I didn't even know he was sick.
I think he was having fun in the same way, you know, when they got blown out and he was like, oh, was that actually the score? Like, I think he was having fun with the reporters a little bit.
So I pulled up the box score to this game where Scotty gets hurt. Let me tell you this. I mean, the people, they just love to big up MJ. If a guy has this game and doesn't make that shot at the end in 2020, I mean, this dude gets wrecked. Michael shot 35 times, made 15 of them, went to the line 15 times. I mean, bro, let Kukoc shoot. Kukoc plays 42 minutes, shoots 14 times, makes 7 shots, one of them being a 3-pointer, doesn't turn the ball over at all, only commits 3 fouls. Like, Kukoc is there busting his ass for 44 minutes while Pippen is on the bench. Rodman only shoots 3 times. Like, Michael literally is just not passing the ball during this game. Like, literally it's just like, we're going to win or lose this game based on how many times I can get the ball in the basket. Because he just, like, he was not passing the ball.
Yeah. Well, what about the thing about Steve Kerr where it's like, yeah, I get like 5 shots a game and I got to make the most of them. And then it's like, yeah, Steve Kerr was a career like 50%. Three-point shooter. Like, maybe he should have gotten a few more looks after the double teams were coming for you, Michael.
Kerr, 0 field goal attempts, 0 field goals made, 0 free throw attempts in 24 minutes in this game 6. Literally, the only stats he recorded were 1 turnover, 3 assists, and 1 steal. I mean, the man got marginalized. And you got to think, I'm thinking of all the great matchups for Steve Kerr. Got to feel like Stockton versus Kerr is a fair fight. You know
that
what I mean?
That does seem like a fair fight, yeah.
So, I mean, I do. I want to talk a little bit about Kerr. Where I just think that dude is such a grinder. And I also want to recant my previous take that I think that Kerr and MJ don't get along. I think that in episodes 9 and 10, I think that like the very obvious mutual respect between those two guys really came through. I actually think kind of the way Michael talks about Kerr is honestly more respectful than the way he talks about like almost anyone else in the entire documentary, because Kerr never let him down. There was like, he never played. If you look at the years Kerr was with the Bulls, every year they played together, they were in the finals, you know, they won. So he never experienced disappointment with Kerr, basically.
Yeah. No. Yeah. And I like that part too, about him looking at the team photo with John Paxson and being like, that's my role. That's what I can do for this team. And then Paxson taking him under his wing was cool. One random thing from the Steve Kerr story that kind of blew my mind. He was talking about how, oh yeah, no girls like me. I wasn't getting any scholarship offers, whatever. oh, and then I just at the last minute got a scholarship to Arizona, like one of the biggest basketball programs going. I'm like, how does that happen from having no interest to then getting to go play at University of Arizona? Like, there seemed to be a little missing there.
I mean, yeah. I mean, Steve Kerr wants to promote his own mysticism a little bit, probably, you know, yeah. Over the course of this. I have heard that that Kerr story before about him not really having any offers, but he also, Kerr was like a really good college player. Like those Arizona teams were really good while he was there. So like yeah. He just had, like, I believe he played, I think maybe they won a national championship while he was there. I gotta go fact check myself on that one. These Michael Jordan suits. I mean, what the fuck? Like, was that cool then?
It had to have been. I mean, I don't think he was like defiantly trying to make a fashion statement and by being rogue. I think he probably truly thought it looked really good.
But he does that stuff now. Like he does the horrible jeans and the mustache and everything now.
Well, you can think about just the 90s in general, the baggy look was such a thing, both for like basketball, like you think about the warm-up pants, like you had the big baggy starter jackets, even in other cultures, like the JNCO jeans were so popular in the 90s, and then everything changed. We, you know, went to skinny jeans and custom tailor fits. So I think he was just like, this is the look, and I'm going to do it to the max.
Well, I mean, so that is, like, I think that is a great point. Like, all the Bulls stuff, to me, looked really cool. Like, all the warm-ups, all the jerseys, all the hats. Like, I'm like, oh, these dudes are so cool. And then you get them off the floor, and they're wearing these oversized suits. And, like all the suits were just terrible to me. Like, they looked like such jokers.
Well, that's the thing, that kind of more baggy stuff like looks good in an athletic setting, but it doesn't look good in like a business formal setting. Then it just looks right. clownish.
So, okay, another thing that I thought was pretty great was they were at the very beginning of episode 10, the guy who wrote Rare Air says Michael Jordan's skill more than anything was that he was present. He was able to be there in the moment. And I thought about that. And at first I was like, that's really stupid. You know, that was not Michael Jordan's skill. I kind of think maybe that's right though. Like maybe the, of all the things that were able to separate Michael Jordan's mentality, it was that he was able to divorce himself from like the anxiety and the tension of worrying about expectations and just be where he was. Maybe that is true.
So here's my thing. From a documentary storytelling perspective, I hated that they used that quote, because what we saw then after that was the ultimate footage that showed that. We had LeBron. We had Michael in the hotel room playing the piano, someone asking him about his future, him literally quoting.
Yeah, literally saying, be in the moment.
Zen Buddha. Just let the footage do that. I hate when they undercut that and they're like, guess what we're going to show you? Michael was so in the moment, and now we have a clip to show it. Like, I hate that from a storytelling perspective. It's just, you have the footage to tell us or show us. You don't need to tell us that.
Yeah. I mean, I agree with that. Like, show, don't tell is like sort of the first rule of movie making, writing a book and all that stuff. But I had never really thought of Michael that way before. Right. Like I had never really been like, oh, well, you know, his whole thing is mind over matter and effort and trying. But I think, yeah, I think that the point that, you know, it really is more about his ability to just stay extremely grounded in the most insane moments. Cause I think we've seen a lot of professional athletes be unable to be grounded. Like, you know, one of the things that people talk about with Brady is why the Patriots are, you know, so good in big games is Brady has played all these big games so many times that, like at the Super Bowl, he's used to the 45-minute halftime, whereas I'm sure Patrick Mahomes is sitting in the locker room just going nuts for 45 minutes because he doesn't know what to do with all of his energy and everything. Like, and I think there's a huge amount to be said for that.
Yeah, and again, aside from the way that they, you know, showed it in the documentary, I do agree with it, and it's something you hear a lot about, you know, singular talents. I've heard it like with politicians, some big time actors, this idea that you'll hear the quote that when you're in a room with them talking, you feel, they make you feel like you're the only person in the room because they are so laser focused on you. And now, Davis, this is going to be really hard for you to imagine, just not, you know, checking your phone mid conversation, that these guys like look right. and they make you feel like you're the only thing that matters. And it definitely seemed like Jordan had that skill set and that he really did when he was checking in with his security guards or whoever, his teammates, like he truly was not off in this other place thinking about all these other things. And that's why I did believe that about him.
Yeah, I think that too. I think that he has that sort of magnetic, charismatic personality. And I think that even like, let's say we live in a fictional world where LeBron plays for another 10 seasons and equals MJ in number of championships. I don't think you will ever be able to convince the people that lived through the Michael Jordan era that they are comparable players at all. Just because LeBron is as great as he is, as charming as he is, it never feels as sincere with him.
Right. And again, you know, they had completely different goals. Like Michael's goal was to win at all costs. Whatever relationships were jeopardized, it does not matter. It was win, win, win. And LeBron is like, I want to be a global superstar. I want to, you know, push causes that I believe in. I want to, you know, build up these business enterprises. Like he has all these things that he's using to leverage his platform. And so naturally he takes on this different aura where with MJ, it truly was, this guy just wanted to win.
Yeah, he doesn't. We spend what in this documentary, we spend 15 minutes on Space Jam of 10 hours. And most of that was talking about the pickup games that were happening. Whereas like when we get the 10 part Michael Jordan documentary, a 10 part LeBron documentary, a huge part of it is going to be about like, oh, I built my media empire and the decision actually helped me out because of X, Y, and Z. And I think that's true of pretty much all great athletes these days, not just LeBron.
Right. And it's reflected in the tone of, you know, Jordan, what are we, you know, 20 some years later reflecting on these moments, and his emotional responses to these are like, they just happened. And, you know, it's obviously a running joke about how he handles these slights and never lets them go. Like LeBron, when they do this documentary in 20 years about him, he's going to be pretty chilled out, kind of laughing. Oh yeah, that was funny. Like he is going to be in a much better headspace. Like Jordan still loses.
He doesn't seem happy, bro. This is actually a great point. Michael Jordan, clearly not a happy man, clearly is still upset at Jerry Krause and Jerry Reinsdorf for not allowing him to come back to play. Still holds still, if he saw Scottie Burrell today, he'd probably call him like some homophobic word and be like, get out of here. I don't want to hang out with you, Scottie Burrell. Like he is like Michael Jordan, not a happy man.
No. And the thing is, I don't, who cares if Reinsdorf lets them come back? Who cares if they win a seventh championship? Well, at some point this is going to end. And honestly, what Jordan's really mad at is just his own mortality. There's no way a guy that just wants to win, win, win at that level at all costs. Obviously, Father Time catches up and you can't do that forever. So when Jordan's angry, he has his different villains in his head, whether it's Krause or Reinsdorf or whoever. But really, he's just mad that he can't be at the top forever.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, all of us, we all want to be on top forever. Hilarious moment to me. Game 3, Utah Jazz. They cut to the bench. Michael Jordan says, everyone scored but Bill. And freaking Bill Wennington squares up and hits like a 20-foot jumper. Like just imagine the disrespect of like aging, close to retirement Bill Wennington taking you off the dribble and hitting a 20-foot jumper. Like that might have been like, imagine it. Like that's so disrespectful.
It's so sad too, because all those guys, you could just tell how badly they wanted to get Michael's approval, to be in his good graces. And the fact that, again, the kind of gravitas that he carried, even with his own teammates, they were terrified of him. They wanted to please him. Everything was in service of Michael Jordan, which just really speaks to his gravitas. It's nuts.
I also think it's important to make this point. Michael Jordan is a weird dude. Michael Jordan is a weirdo. His best friends were his security guards. He was paying his best friends to hang out with him, you know, and his relationships with his teammates were, you know, obviously there's a whole element of, you know, the power dynamics at play there. Seems like most of the opponents he played against, he was pathologically competitive with them, was not making close friendships with very many of these people. Like a big takeaway to me is that Michael Jordan is a weird guy.
Oh, very, very weird. I think that's the takeaway. That's what's so hard about it is, again, I think the whole thing about the MJ story is these are the sacrifices, both for your own mental health, both for how you treat other people, that come for just wanting to win at all costs. And you create this great legacy, but you also have to ask yourself at what cost. And you can see that in his discontent now, is that he's still wrestling with that stuff. It's a real, like, what do you have to sacrifice to actually get to this point?
Yeah, that is true. One of the notes I made while I was watching is that, you know, you see Michael talking in these clips from the 90s, you know, like all the old media, you see him chatting with Ahmad Rashad, and this is even, you know, within 5 years of his dad dying, and he just seems much happier and calmer in the 90s than he does now. Like I think a lot of the interview footage shot with him when they were doing The Last Dance, when they were working on this documentary, like, I think he seems like bummed out, right? Like, it seems like he is not happy with, like just not happy with his circumstances and his surroundings now. And he was much happier being in the middle of it.
Yeah. And it's also curious because, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, we don't hear much from Jordan these days of things he's working on. You'd think there would be other things where he was scratching that competitive itch. And it's kind of bizarre. It almost feels like you kind of believe the idea that he's sitting in his mansion or whatever, just kind of wallowing and replaying all these highlights in his head over and over. Like, it's like, what is Jordan doing now? He has the money, the platform, the access, the connections to do quite literally whatever he wants. And he's not doing anything, right?
Well, I mean, he owns a basketball team and they just suck.
But is he even, like, in what capacity is he involved with regular operations? Like, I never hear about, like, Jordan, you know, influence this move or wants to do
yeah,
this.
Yeah, you never, yeah, you don't really hear about. I mean, seems like maybe he doesn't want to spend them that far into the luxury tax or whatever. I mean, I would imagine if I had to guess with Jordan, he probably plays a lot of golf.
Yeah.
I think he drinks a lot. I think Michael Jordan drinks a lot and smokes a lot of cigars, and it's just like sort of like not that healthy of a person.
Well, like, this is another fun thought experiment. I just cannot picture Michael Jordan at home just scrolling through Netflix and throwing something on. The dude is definitely watching old tapes from like the 92 finals.
Or I mean, he just is watching basketball for sure. Like even if he's not, or something competitive, right? Or yeah like I don't think he is. I mean, I don't know, man. That's it is fascinating to imagine what is Michael Jordan's home life like. Yeah. Like, who knows? I mean, we get no sense of that from the documentary. We don't hear from the woman he was married to and divorced from in this. We hear a little bit from his mom, who he seems to have spent a lot of time with. Seems like she was there a lot after his dad died, which, like, whatever. And we get the sense that he spent a lot of time with his security guards, but, like, doing what? Like, you know, what is he gambling against his mom? Is he like haranguing? Is he like haranguing his mom to play the quarter game? Like, you know what I mean? Seems wild.
I know. As much as I enjoyed watching this documentary, I would trade all 10 episodes for like a one episode about Jordan's day-to-day life now. You know, just like what he's up to, what his thought is, what gets him up in the morning. You know,
yeah. What is Michael Jordan doing during quarantine? You know.
Yeah.
Seriously. It is a fascinating question. So I think, let's see, do we have anything else here? I guess just really hilarious, like how much people hate Karl Malone. That was like a really interesting thing, like of people tweeting during this. Cause again, I did not live through the Jazz. It seems like the Jazz were like the police though. Like no one like the Jazz sucked. No one liked the Jazz. No one wanted them to beat the Bulls. And I mean, I don't know. You know, I didn't live through it. I would imagine that they were like the super dweeby team because of what was involved with like, you know, they were in Utah. All their fans were white and lame. But yeah, I mean, I don't really know though.
Yeah, it's funny too, because I actually shared in, you know, obviously as just being a Jordan fan, but I was also a Denver Nuggets fan. And the Nuggets, when they had pulled off that upset over the Supersonics, the one over the eight seed or the eight over the one in 94, and then they got trounced by the Jazz. And I, just as a kid who just wanted the Nuggets to be so good, and watching that brutal efficiency of the pick and roll and the whitewashed Utah Jazz fans, like, I hated them so much. And there was something so... I don't know if it was their style of play. There was a smugness to them as well. And just, it was, there was no flair. There wasn't anything exciting. They were really easy to hate because they were just super efficient, but unlikable.
Yeah. Which is, that's probably how a lot of people view the Warriors actually, as like not being all that likable. I don't know. I always kind of like them, but there are probably some comparables there. I mean, I think a big difference though from the NBA then to now is like it is not the popular teams are very rarely the most liked teams. People actually hate the best teams. Like, people hated the Heat, people hated the Warriors, whereas back then it seemed like everyone was pretty much rooting the Bulls on. And then before the Bulls, it seemed like if you weren't a Celtics or a Lakers fan, you picked one of the two of them and then rooted for them.
Yeah. And again, it goes back to why Jordan was the greatest story. We see people debating all the time. It was like, oh, well, who's the best player on the Warriors? Is it KD? Is it Steph or whatever? Like, if people have a hard time being like, well, what if this team is just the sum of their parts or whatever? The Jordan thing was, there's this one guy who's the singular best talent. Everyone else is just a role player helping him accomplish his goal, quite literally putting the team on his back. How many field goal attempts? People love that, you know, that this brutal efficiency, you know, playing the game in the most optimal way. That's boring from a storytelling perspective for people.
Yeah, the hero of the story being math, not inspiring anyone, right? Like learning that 3 is greater than 2, that doesn't inspire a wave of kids. Though I mean, kids are wanting to be Steph Curry. Like, kids are buying those super ugly Under Armour shoes, you know, like that is a thing. I actually think there's more interesting stuff to be said and written and talked about with Curry than there will be with LeBron at the end of the day. Like, Curry is a more like inspirational figure than LeBron is, because many people can see themselves like, oh, I can figure out how to make the ball go in the hoop, but like, you're never going to be 6'8", 260 and be able to play every position on the court, you know?
Right. And it's a slight shift. Like, kids, they want to shoot like Steph Curry. They see their body type and they're like, okay, I could walk down, pull up, you know, from 4 feet behind the arc and drain it. When people want to be like Mike, they're like, I want to win. I want to be the best. I want to have all these championships. It's like a different kind of wish fulfillment fantasy.
Yeah, for sure. So the way the documentary ended, the footage in Grant Park, actually, because like, I've spent so much time in Grant Park, like Lollapalooza and being up in Chicago and everything, and then like seeing all those people considering what we're dealing with now with like COVID-19, like, it made me a little emotional, because I was like, this literally may never happen again. Like, Grant Park may never actually have that many people in it ever again for any reason, because it's not safe. And you know, I need to make this point that oftentimes in the past, I've taken the role of like, oh, these boomers and their Michael Jordan memories. Like, well, this is so stupid. Like, he was a really good player, but, you know, he'd be like, whatever. That last shot against the Jazz, where like, he's exhausted, he's played 43 minutes up until that point, Pippen's hurt, and making that shot with the defender in his face, like, that is not a Paul Bunyan story. Like, that really was an incredible, incredible moment. Like that was very cool to watch 20 years later, knowing that the shot was going in.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, not to sound like a broken record, but it's, again, they show all these Eastern Conference Finals and the NBA Finals. And like, it seems like there's 2 or 3 game winning shots he hits in all of those series. It's just unreal the amount of confidence he had in himself to get those done time after time. It is like, even though I tend towards being, you know, more cynical about this stuff and keeping, you know, my emotions at a distance,
right,
you can't help but get caught up in it. It really is an incredible feeling.
They can't win until we quit, which I thought was sort of the that was like the rallying cry. So Jordan says that they're all drinking champagne and smoking cigars down in the depths of the, I guess, the Delta Center then. And he goes, you know, they can't win until we quit. And then Scottie Pippen and Michael Jordan and Phil Jackson, they all say, Jerry Krause, he was the one. He was the one who brought us all together. He was the one. He was the one who did it. And I thought that was a very nice gesture by all of them.
See, I got, like, when Scottie said it, I was like, this sounds so disingenuous. Like, it almost felt
like disingenuously touting.
Yeah. One other funny thing about after they won that, how bizarre, like, I thought it was classy, but how bizarre is it that Karl Malone walks on the bus and goes all the way back to congratulate. Obviously, they didn't cross paths, and I mean, that's an incredibly classy gesture, but I'm also like, why are you getting on their bus?
Yeah, I mean, that's very bizarre. Although it seems like from the footage, that was just a really normal thing that happened then, like, or that the guys would meet in the tunnel in between the two locker rooms pretty much every night after the games. Like, every night they would, you know, they would come in and be like, okay, let's do this, boys. So I don't know. I guess that was just more normal then. Those guys all knew each other, you know, so much more back then, I guess. Like, they were all friends.
Yeah. Oh, I did want to circle back to one of the things you're talking about Grant Park. And again, another thing I'm generally cynical about of, like, because we know how, you know, traditional fandom can result in weird tribalism and this stuff. But you really do. You see the joy on those people's faces in Chicago. And you do remember there is this element of sports where the stuff it can do for a community and the distraction it offers us, like you said, you know, juxtapose against our current situation, like seeing what sports does for people. It is an incredibly powerful thing, even though the dark side of it is bad. In those moments, you're like, this is why we do it.
Yeah. Like, sports does make a difference to people. Like, in the middle of this global pandemic, like, people want distractions. People like, the popularity of sports, yes, it is a business. Yes, it does make billions of dollars for people who already have billions of dollars. But, like, it does make a difference in people's lives. Michael Jordan made a difference in, I mean, probably billions of people's lives. Michael probably did touch the lives of a billion people, which is crazy to think about. But that's almost certainly true.
Definitely. It definitely is true. And man, I hope Norman Chad doesn't hear this, man. He's going to be pissed.
Oh yeah. These retire all sports aren't that cool, or we don't need sports takes. Just retire them all. They're all stupid.
He did his job for the post. He got the clicks.
Yeah. Well, he did what he needed to do. All right. Larry Bird telling MJ, you bitch, fuck you. Yeah. And then Michael telling him to go work on his golf game. I thought that was, it would have been a more fitting ending to see some antagonizing like that at the very, very end instead of, and we didn't even get any highlights of MJ getting shots up as a wizard either. What a bummer.
I know. And you know, they wanted, like, that story does deserve even like a one, not even, it doesn't even have to be
like its own hour.
Yeah. Actually, real quick, what did you, so there were moments where I got caught up, like, emotionally with the storytelling. Did you get caught up by the burning of the paper ritual?
Yes. Yeah. But did? I like to be the Zoomer millennial who's too cool for that stuff. But the idea of sitting in a room with your closest comrades and, you know, undergoing this like very cleansing ritual, like, oh, for sure, that got to me. Like, I was like, wow, that's actually amazing.
I was shocked that something like that would happen, but I was also thinking about it from the perspective of, you know, in our lives, so many things that that have finality. You know, we get graduations when, you know, we, you know, move on from schooling. Like, there's all these events that mark, but like when you're an NBA team and you win a champion, like, sure, you get your parade, but then it's just like, they all knew they were never going to step in a gym and practice together again. So that was pretty incredible for Phil Jackson to be like, I am going to manufacture this moment for us to signal this era ending. That was cool.
Yeah. I mean, Phil Jackson, to me, he definitely is a guy who stayed around basketball too long. But again, another guy who to me comes off pretty favorable in this documentary, I thought, overall.
Yeah. Yeah, he did. And and you definitely, and Phil Jackson, obviously no one needs to hear someone say, you know, Phil is very good.
Wow. Great coach, Phil Jackson.
but you do hear some of the stuff that he did and the way he kind of thought outside the box to not only manage these personalities, but to also create this kind of weird Zen teamwork atmosphere that clearly helped.
Okay, last thing here, and then I'll let you get to your heart out. Rodman leaving to skip practice to go to Vegas and take place in a worldwide wrestling thing with Hulk Hogan, noted racist Hulk Hogan, and like I mean imagine something like that happening. Like, literally would be the most impossible thing of the whole documentary. Someone will win 6 championships in a row again before that happens.
And what's so crazy about it is, you know, early in the documentary, he had his little rumspringa when he went to Vegas. And the idea was he was kind of laying low, just go blow off some steam. This was the most high profile possible, like, thing. It was like, it wasn't like you'd be like, I showed up to practice, I was like hanging low in like the back of a bar. No, like, you're on national television in the one of the most important series of your career. That's what was so, like, he was just rubbing it in their face. There was no even intention to hide that he needed a break or whatever. It's crazy.
Yeah. I just, they don't make him like Rodman anymore. He was fascinating to me during the documentary, though. If you're out there on the internet, you want to learn about Rodman, you can, but there's some very unsavory stuff out there about him too, as there are with most people. People contain multitudes, Peter. And maybe that's the story of the Chicago Bulls, is that people are never as simple as good or bad, and they often are somewhere in between.
Yeah, and I think that's a good and where I'm at is, like, I think it doesn't have to be mutually exclusive that you love this documentary, but also carry a healthy amount of skepticism about how stuff was presented and the things that were left out.
I mean, yeah, imagine if someone made a documentary and they don't talk to any of your ex-girlfriends, and they don't talk to anyone that fired you. They only talk to the people that got the best of you. And even when those people say something bad, you're allowed to have them edit it out at the end. Like, yeah, that'd probably be pretty cool. Like, if they made a documentary about me winning a League of Legends GPP and didn't make a documentary about, you know, the $1,500 that I donked off before that, it'd probably be pretty great.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, MJ, I think this was great for everyone in general. We all enjoyed it. And if anything, it's made me more curious to go dig in and find more information about this time and kind of seek out more of the full picture. It's like, we've heard Jordan's story. I hope maybe some stuff comes out of this, of people interviewing more behind the scenes people and getting their takes, almost like a rebuttal, or here's my take on a story that was told. That would be cool if that crops out from this.
Yeah, there is a whole cottage industry of like a podcast series with Scotty Burrell and Bill Cartwright, yeah, and John Paxson and stuff, like, of more MJ stories to be told. I think that people would get pretty interested in. So that's it. The Last Dance has concluded. I hope that sports, you know, kind of slowly starts to trickle back, because that was like a cool communal experience to look forward to every week, and it's going to be a bummer to miss out on that now.
Yeah, I'm going to miss it. I don't even like watching movies because I find them generally too long, but getting to sit down on Sundays for 2 hours and watch this, and I never felt like it was dragging or that there was a lot of, I thought it was actually pretty tightly edited. And I know some people were complaining about kind of their time construction where they were jumping back and forth, but I appreciated it. I thought it really set up context, and there were a few times where it was confusing, like, wait, which year, which series is this? But for the most part, I thought it was a good storytelling structure.
For sure. I thought that the duality of like following his entire career and then marrying it to that 98 season was an intelligent way to do things. You know, I think that a lot of filmmakers would have done something different with it and gone in a different direction. So I thought that was pretty great. So everyone, thank you very much for listening to our Last Dance recap series here on the TakeCast. We will be back soon with more content for you guys. And now, take it easy.